The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We didn't think this was going to be this bad in January. The intelligence community has obviously been raising alarm bells about this for months now. You know, we had data sort of underpinning how pandemics like this work. Obviously, this is a novel virus, and there's a lot of questions that we don't have answered yet, as almost any public health expert in the country will say right now. But I do think there's sort of some basic questions to be answered about: should the United States broadly, not just DOD, have moved quicker to put essentially lockdown measures in place? I think that's going to be the big question is, did we start talking about flattening the curve? Did we start talking about upgrading the health protection status of individual installations? Did we start having any of those conversations soon enough? And if this happens again, how do we determine what the trigger is for instituting some of these sort of broader and more stringent protection measures?
I'm Margaret Taylor, senior editor at Lawfare. On this bonus edition of the Lawfare podcast, I sat down virtually with Robbie Gramer, a diplomacy and national security reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine covering the State Department. And my colleague Scott Anderson sat down remotely with Katie Bo Williams, the senior national security correspondent for the Defense One news outlet. We talked about how the Department of State and the Department of Defense are responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, including the impact on the workforce of these agencies, their efforts to assist and protect Americans abroad and domestically, and the broader national security and foreign policy consequences for the United States. It's the Lawfare Podcast, bonus edition: how the State Department and the Defense Department are responding to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Katie, let's start with brass tacks. Do we have an idea about how many DOD personnel have been diagnosed with COVID-19 or quarantined on account of it?
Yeah, so the DOD has been putting out a daily fact sheet where they give us a sense of how many service members that they have that have been diagnosed with COVID-19 every day. Those numbers right now, as we're recording on Thursday morning, are in the kind of mid-200s. They've been steadily increasing over the last week. And one of the really striking things that we've seen literally just moments before we sat down to record this, Scott, is the entirety of the USS Theodore Roosevelt, which is an aircraft carrier that's currently in the Indo-Pacific right now, is going to be tested for coronavirus, because they have had now, I think, something like 20-odd positive cases on the aircraft carrier. So that really gives you a sense of how dramatically this virus might be able to spread in kind of large groups of service members, but who are kind of kept together on a small installation like an aircraft carrier. You know, it's hard to do social distancing when you've got 5,000 guys, 5,000 crew members on an aircraft carrier sitting in the middle of the ocean. So that, I think, really gives you a sense of some of the vulnerabilities that the U.S. military is facing, as just around the world, as they try to think about how to deal with keeping the spread of this disease away from their service members.
The situation you describe with the Theodore Roosevelt really captures one of the unique challenges facing DOD. As an agency, a lot of its core functions require personnel to work in close proximity to each other, cohabitate. What strategies have we seen DOD adopt to try and adapt these activities in response to the COVID-19 threat?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing a growing awareness in Pentagon leadership that they're going to have to take a more top-down approach to managing the spread of this disease. Initially, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper was really trying to push a lot of these decisions down to the command level, you know, saying, okay, well, your situation over here in U.S. Forces Korea is going to be completely different from the situation on, say, Fort Campbell in Kentucky, the Army base in Kentucky. So that, I think we've started to see, didn't really work in the sense that a lot of lower level commanders and service members were starting to say, you know, well, look, it doesn't seem like to me that my commander or my base or what have you is doing enough to really enforce some of these social distancing measures that the public health experts are saying in the civilian world are critical to making sure that we stay safe. So, I just as a journalist have gotten lots of calls and emails from service members, both inside the Pentagon and at bases across the U.S. saying, you know, look, I'm still seeing guys gathering in large groups to do PT or gather for formation. And isn't that a huge risk factor? Just in the last week, we've started to see OSD take some more stringent steps kind of from the top. They've upgraded what's called the health protection status for the entire U.S. military to a level that basically to the second highest level that basically insists on things like health screenings if you're going to enter a facility. It limits gatherings to small groups. It makes sure that if you're coming into a particular installation, it's mission essential work only, that kind of thing. The other thing is just in the last couple of days, they've put a 60-day freeze on all troop movements overseas. It's hard to overstate, I think, how dramatically that could reshape what the U.S. military's mission looks like in the long term, even after this is over. I've had sort of a couple of officials say to me things like, well, you know, if you pause something, you know, they've paused training with the Iraqi security forces, the training mission in Iraq. You know, if you pause these kind of missions indefinitely, what's to say that they're going to get restarted when this is all over? You know, inertia is a powerful thing in a bureaucracy the size of the Pentagon. So I think there's a lot of shifts that we're seeing both kind of from the sort of top-down level in terms of providing dictates to different commands and installations across the world, but also, you know, changes that might potentially have long-term consequences.
One thing that DoD is known for is planning. It's an agency full of planners who love to develop contingencies and keep books of them filed away for future use. But here it seems like DoD's response to COVID-19 has been slow and somewhat improvised. Do they have protocols in place to handle something like this? And if not, why not?
That's kind of the $300 million question, Scott. We saw the Joint Chief of Staff surgeon yesterday get up on the podium and say, look, we didn't know this was going to be this bad in January, as kind of an explanation for why we weren't seeing sort of stricter health protection measures for service members put in place sooner. You know, why wasn't the Pentagon sort of prepared to be ramped up to go to HipCon Charlie, you know, a month ago, for example, instead of sort of now waiting until they've had their first confirmed case of COVID-19 inside the Pentagon? And I'm not sure there's a satisfactory answer to that question yet. A lot of the folks inside the Pentagon who've been reaching out to me, sort of military officials who work throughout the building, including at least one senior defense official, have said to me, it's hard for us to see anything but political pressure from the top, either from the White House or from the political leadership at the Pentagon, that this wasn't sort of locked, that the building and other DoD installations weren't locked down sooner. Their point being exactly what you've just said. This is a building full of planners. There are almost certainly contingency plans sitting on the shelf for what to do in the case of a pandemic. The question is, why weren't they implemented earlier? Why are we only sort of now on March 26th, you know, the week of, you know, March 26th, seeing some of these measures like moving the Pentagon to HipCon Charlie? Why are we only seeing those now?
You just published a great article in Defense One describing what you call the lurching effort to respond to COVID-19 at DoD, and particularly within the Pentagon. Can you give us a sense of what it's like to work in the Pentagon right now?
Yeah, so Right now, inside the building, senior aides to the executive assistants or the senior aides to senior leaders inside the Pentagon are getting what I think are daily briefings from the body that's in charge of basically the administration of the Pentagon reservation, this sort of entire complex. And they have been recording the number of swipes in and out of the building as there have been sort of increasing telework restrictions put on folks coming in and out. On Friday, they were at about 30% of normal traffic in and out of the building, which is obviously a huge, huge decrease. But even then, you were seeing this administrative body say, that's too much. We got to get the numbers down. That's about 8,000 people. On Wednesday, by 9:30 in the morning, there were still 5,000 people that had swiped themselves into the Pentagon. That's the Pentagon's a big building, but that's still a lot of people. And I think the frustration, one of the frustrations that I'm hearing anyway, is that even though they have kind of upgraded the health protection status for the building to HIPCON Charlie, what I'm told from folks who work in the building is that a lot of the health screening measures that are supposed to go along with that, which is temperature taking and a couple of questions about potential symptoms, is just not happening because there isn't the capacity to do that for 5,000 people. The other thing that I'm hearing is that the delivery of the POM is right now, OSD is still asking that to be on schedule, service branches budget requests. That's something that's really hard for Pentagon workers to do remotely. So there's guys that are still coming in the building to work on that. And that is something that I think I'm hearing from some military officers in the building that, you know, why are we still trying to get this done on this accelerated schedule to get it done by the beginning of the summer when we could sort of easily push that back a few months and ease the burden on the building and sort of ease the number of people that are coming in and out of the door.
Now, obviously, DOD personnel work on a lot of very sensitive issues that might be hard to handle remotely, as do people working in the State Department at the CIA. How are they adapting this part of their mission? Do we have a sense of what staffing levels are actually needed for these functions? And how does that compare to the actual staffing levels we see on the ground?
So right now, guys that I'm talking to who work sort of, I think what can be called sort of mission essential functions that require them to be inside of a SCIF that they really can't do telework on. It sounds like individual offices are kind of implementing as best of restrictions as they can sort of as they go along. My understanding is that guys are working in shifts rather than kind of be all on top of each other all the time. And then there's sort of increased cleaning and again, just sort of just an awareness of like, how far away can I stay from my colleague, but they're sort of trying to, I think, stagger how some of these workers that are working in SCIFs are coming in so that they're not all on top of one another, essentially. But I mean, that to a certain degree is a judgment call, right? Like you have to balance, okay, well, how critical is it for, you know, this person to be in this chair doing whatever this job is? You know, is it keeping people safe somewhere across the globe? Or is it something that we can, you know, is it something that we can sacrifice to prevent the spread of the disease? Because of course, sort of the fundamental paradox that the Pentagon is facing is they do have a huge responsibility to protect the country. You can't totally shut down what the Defense Department does overnight and assume that we're going to continue to be safe. But at the same time, of course, you have to protect their workforce. And so I think one of the things that OSD is grappling with is where is the line there? You know, what is the appropriate balance of those two things?
Of course, the Defense Department doesn't just run facilities for soldiers and warfighters. It also oversees facilities that house and care for military families, as well as the service academies and other training sites. Have we seen an equally behind-the-curve approach at those facilities? Or has there been more of an effort to match civilian community risk mitigation practices like social distancing?
That's a good question, Scott. I haven't covered that as closely, so I'm not sure I can give you a great answer to that. I know that places like Military Times and Task and Purpose and Stars and Stripes, I think, have done as good of a job as they're able sort of throughout the strictures of this disease to cover that angle of the story. But I don't honestly have a lot to say about that.
Fair enough. That's okay. You had talked a little bit about the operational impact of all of this, but I want to come back to that. You mentioned the 60-day freeze, which does seem like a decision with major strategic ramifications, one that might result in interruptions in various ongoing mission sets and activities. How is COVID-19 impacting the overall operational picture at DOD? What activities are being curtailed? Are there certain regions or mission sets that are being disproportionately affected?
Readiness. This is like the number one big question that is sort of consuming the Pentagon right now, which is how do we make sure that we are not sort of presenting an easy target for adversaries based on the fact that we're all sort of hunkered down right now and not engaging in training exercises. In Iraq, I think one of the really interesting things that we've watched is that they have not only have they paused training exercises with the Iraqi security forces, but they have also sort of accelerated a long planned move to consolidate U.S. forces away from some of the more forward deployed and exposed bases and kind of back towards locations where they're able to better protect the force. And we are told that this is in part due to sort of increased activity by some of the Iranian-backed militias in the area, but also due to coronavirus. You know, this idea that you need to not have folks sort of out exposed in these forward deployed bases where we can't get to them with healthcare and where they are sort of exposed to one of the number one risks of being inside Iraq right now, which is its porous border with Iran, which is obviously itself having a huge outbreak of coronavirus. The other mission that I think I'm sort of closely watching right now is what happens in Afghanistan. With this 60-day pause, we are told that the pause is not going to impact this sort of first stage drawdown down to 8,600 troops that's supposed to be done by midsummer. Whether that means that those troops that are supposed to be withdrawn as part of that effort are still coming out, as we were told that they were leading into this shutdown, or whether that means they're just going to have to accelerate that process when the 60 days is done, I don't know. We don't know right now. But I think what this sort of freeze means for the sort of longer term feasibility of the American plan to get out of Afghanistan, I think is an unanswered question in a lot of ways. And it should tell you something that even amidst the sort of convulsion of national crisis mode that we're in here in the United States, the Secretary of State still found time to hop on an airplane and race over to Kabul to try to meet the two warring presidents of Afghanistan right now and try to get them to make a resolution about who was actually leading the country in order to try to preserve the long-term viability of these peace talks. So there's still stuff going on, behind the scenes. They're obviously making as much of an effort as they can to not allow some of these sort of long-term initiatives, I think particularly in the Central Command, AOR, to totally fall by the wayside. But, you know, it's unavoidable that if you say things like, we're going to put a 60-day freeze on the movement of troops, we're going to withdraw from particular bases, we're going to, we're going to freeze training operations, it's inevitable that that's going to have a long-term impact on the mission.
You've already mentioned the normal budgetary process that's usually in full gear at this point of the year, as agencies get ready to present their requests to Congress. So far, we've seen that the Armed Services Committees in Congress have said that they want to keep that process on track. Most notably, there's a markup for the next year's National Defense Authorization Act that's still scheduled for late April. And there have been talks about a remote markup, possibly to keep that process on track, presumably with hopes of wrapping it up in advance of the 2020 elections, just as they did in 2018 for those elections. What impact is COVID likely to have on that process? And what will that mean for DoD's readiness moving forward, even after the immediate crisis around the coronavirus hopefully passes?
Well, I mean, so I think there's two things going on right now. Number one, I do know that there is a push inside the building, at least from certain corners in certain services, to try to slow down the schedule, the internal schedule for delivery of the POM, because they're saying, look, this is a way that we can kind of get some of these people out of the building. This is not work that they can do easily via telework. So rather than having folks come into the building and work on this, like, let's just take a breath and push it back, you know, a month, a couple of months. I believe the original deadline that OSD had asked the services to meet was the beginning of June. My understanding is that there have been at least some requests that have so far been rebuffed to try to push that back, at least a month or a couple of months. The other big question and the big unknown here is, what does Congress do overall, not just what do the Armed Services Committees do, but Is Congress going to have to, they've just passed this $2 trillion package in the Senate, is Congress going to have to come back and do another one of these, or are they essentially going to shut down for a couple of months? You know, remember, this is an institution made up of septuagenarians and octogenarians who are, in theory, some of the most high-risk individuals for contracting COVID-19, or rather for having COVID-19 be a particularly serious and potentially deadly disease. And so, you know, whether or not Congress stays away, tries how they figure out how to try to do some of their work remotely, particularly some of the sort of ongoing wrangling that's being done over remote voting. You know, I think we just don't know an answer to a lot of those questions. And that, more than anything, is gonna impact, I think, the budgetary process, because at the end of the day, of course, you know, that's the end user. That's who's gonna make some of these decisions.
Absolutely. Now, DOD has also come up in the conversation around COVID-19, not just because of its military capabilities, but also because of its role in backstopping civilian capabilities. So there have been discussions of having the military set up field hospitals, for example, to alleviate pressure on the civilian medical system, or of having the Defense Logistics Agency take over efforts to produce and distribute medical supplies. Is this amplifying the impact of COVID-19 on DOD preparedness by further draining its resources? Or are these sorts of activities kind of separate from DOD's core warfighting functions?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure we understand yet the trade-off, because I don't think we know what, to a certain degree, we don't know what the bottom line number is. How much is DOD spending on the kinds of things that it's doing to assist the civilian sector right now? And I think there's some question about, you know, where the bodies are being drawn from, essentially. But the two big things that we've seen them do so far deploy the Mercy and the Comfort to hotspots on the East Coast and the West Coast. One of them is going to Seattle. The other one is going to New York. And then we've also seen the Army Corps of Engineer be deployed to New York to help with the building of overflow hospital capacity. And you're right to point out that this is about relieving strain on civilian healthcare systems, because, you know, as we've heard sort of repeatedly from the Pentagon, the Comfort, the Mercy, you know, any of these kind of expeditionary hospital facilities that DOD is able to stand up fairly quickly, they're designed for combat casualties. They're not designed for infectious diseases. It's a lot of beds that are crammed right in there close together. This is not social distancing friendly. And so the idea is that, you know, you would be able to deploy some of these assets to allow other patients that would normally have gone to the hospital for whatever is wrong with them to go to the Comfort, for example, and receive care there, and allow local hospitals to sort of focus on the coronavirus response. So, one of those ships was already in maintenance. The Comfort was sitting in Norfolk and undergoing a regular maintenance cycle, which has been accelerated in order to get it to New York. So, you know, that's something that was already being done anyway. You know, the question sort of becomes where would these ships have gone otherwise? You know, what would this money that the Army Corps of Engineer is now spending to help produce it at the Javits Center in New York? You know, what would that have been used for? And I think that's something that's going to have to be in accounting with time. You know, I don't think sitting here right now, I think DOD is sort of doing that calculus in real time. Okay, where can we afford to pull assets and where can we not? I do know that in the National Guard, one of the questions is, you know, as the National Guard, sort of both at the state level and then now some of these sort of federalized Guard troops under Title 32, one of the things that they are dealing with is, okay, well, we have a lot of guardsmen who are physicians, for example, but if you call up that particular guardsman, you are calling him out of his own community to send him to another community. You're asking him to step away from the hospital, you know, that is his home hospital where he works and may also be needed for coronavirus response. So I think there's some real challenges for the Guard in particular as they talk about, you know, how do we combat something that is this widespread across the entire country? You know, okay, you might be able to pull up the Guard, but what are you taking them away from in their own communities?
That brings us to another question. DOD, of course, isn't a freestanding entity. Instead, it relies to a substantial extent on the U.S. industrial base and really the international industrial and trade system to get the equipment and supplies it needs to pursue its mission. Are there concerns that COVID-19 might disrupt these supply lines, either temporarily or permanently? in a way that could have a lasting impact on DoD's effectiveness and preparedness?
Well, okay, so DoD has approved they are donating some medical equipment. I can't think of the numbers off the top of my head. I want to say it was masks. But to your larger point about the supply chain, you know, I've heard concerns from guys inside the Pentagon for I don't know how long that one of the biggest national security concerns that they have is that we as a nation were too reliant on other countries, in particular China, for the kinds of supplies that we are now desperately in need of to combat coronavirus, both on a particularly at the civilian level. You know, we hear this from hospital administrators across the country right now that they can't get masks, ventilators, respirators because their overseas supply chains are frozen and those products aren't being made in the United States. Now, obviously, the private sector is on a voluntary basis right now gearing up to produce some of those items. And certainly, DoD has more experience than any other agency, I would argue, in federal government in kind of using the authorities of the Defense Production Act to contract for needed supplies. And I think that's kind of an ongoing discussion right now, both for DoD itself and for the sort of larger within federal government broadly. I know Ellen Lord's office has been sending aides over to HHS, over to FEMA to kind of basically give them the rundown on like, look, this is how you can use this authority if you need it.
So we started this conversation by noting DoD's reputation as an agency full of planners. And I'm confident that there are already some people in DoD who are beginning to think about what an after-action report from this experience is going to look like, even though we're still in the middle of it. What are some of the lessons that people are talking about DoD needing to draw from this experience, especially as it prepares for the next epidemic or for a future where recurrences of COVID-19 may remain a serious concern?
I think supply chain, the supply chain concerns that we were just talking about is certainly going to be a big part of that discussion, both within DoD and just within government broadly. I mean, obviously, that's been the challenge that has really consumed national politics and the national discussion for weeks now. But I think, you know, I think the big thing is going to be, the big question is going to be, why did it take leadership so long to kind of grasp, oh, wait, this is going to come to the United States and we're going to have some huge problems? You know, as again, you know, hearing from the Joint Staff Surgeon from General Paul Friedrichs just yesterday, we didn't think this was going to be this bad in January. The intelligence community has obviously been raising alarm bells about this for months now. You know, we had data sort of underpinning how pandemics like this work. Obviously, this is a novel virus and there's a lot of questions that we don't have answered yet as almost any public health expert in the country will say right now. But I do think there's sort of some basic questions to be answered about, should the United States broadly, not just DoD, have moved quicker to put lockdown measures in place? I think that's going to be the kind of the big question is, did we start talking about flattening the curve? Did we start talking about upgrading the health protection status of individual installations? Did we start having any of those conversations soon enough? And if this happens again, how do we determine what the trigger is for instituting some of these sort of broader and more stringent protection measures?
Katie Bo Williams, Senior National Security Correspondent for Defense One. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Lawfare Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So, Robbie, let's start with the workforce of the State Department. The State Department has about 75,000 people overseas. Do we know how many cases there are of employees overseas and domestically that have COVID-19?
Yeah, we do. So it actually, we just started learning about this because unlike the Pentagon, which had been sending out regular public updates, the State Department for a while had been sort of vague and cagey about when and how many and where its employees infected with COVID-19 were. At this point, we know that there are about 60 cases worldwide, and then domestically just about over a dozen. But that also comes with the caveat, as with all of this, of, you know, you just don't know how many test kits are available, you know, and for foreign service officers and, you know, a developing country that might not have the healthcare infrastructure, test kits. And also there are some who, you know, might be asymptomatic and have it. So, but in terms of actual recorded cases, it's just under 60 at this point as of last evening.
And what guidance has there been going sort of from State Department management to employees about securing the health of the workforce? Like, what's there? I know I'm in DC, I'm former State Department. I know a lot of my friends are working from home, but tell us what the guidance has been from management.
I think the guidance has been a lot of what you've seen publicly with other agencies, what states and local governments have been telling people, which is, you know, avoid contact as much as possible with other people, you know, wash hands, stay vigilant. If you start feeling sick, definitely try to isolate yourself. The twist here, of course, for the State Department and other federal employees is there's a lot of work that you can't do just working from home. You know, you can't bring classified work home. And so through that, there's been a lot of frustration because there's unclear guidance for federal employees who work in national security issues of what they can do when they can work from home. And so it's sort of from my understanding from the officials I've talked to at the State Department here in DC, is that office by office, they're sort of switching off and having, you know, a team, you know, half their workforce of their office going 1 week, the other half going the other, to try to maximize the distance between people while also taking into account that they can't just do all of their work from home. With that said, it's obviously sort of breaking new territory here, and they're building the plane as they fly it because they've never had to do something like this before. And, you know, it's not like the State Department's IT infrastructure is quite as advanced as, say, a company like Google or Facebook. So they're also having their problems with their video conferencing that you and I are having in our jobs, I'm sure.
So let's talk about one particular class of State Department employees, which is American Citizen Services, you know, consular officers who are abroad, who are assisting, you know, something like 50,000 Americans abroad who I've seen in press reports are struggling to make it home as there are border closings and sort of no-fly orders in various countries. That has been somewhat controversial, I think, because there's been frustration on the part of some of these Americans abroad trying to get home. Walk us through how that particular story has evolved over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of American citizens who are trapped abroad right now, as well as some lawmakers who are hearing from their constituents, as well as even State Department officials themselves, will admit behind the scenes that the State Department was caught flat-footed on this. Even with months of dire health warnings from public officials on how bad this could get before this turned into a full-fledged pandemic, it seems like the State Department was caught off guard and not prepared at all to deal with the magnitude of American citizens reaching out to embassies and consulates abroad trying to get home right now. And it's an unprecedented crisis, both in the number of people trying to get home, but also in the fact that in the past, if American embassies have been trying to get American citizens out of a country here or there, it's been one or two countries, and the international commercial airline system hasn't been totally upended. They could rely on commercial airline flights to come in and ease the burden a lot. That's obviously not the case now with all of these airlines keeping their planes grounded. It seems like the ship is slowly turning. They're starting to right the ship. They're doing a lot more regular briefings with the press. Congressional officials and members of Congress that I've talked to just in the past day say that state's been a lot more responsive in the past week than they were in the weeks leading up to that. And slowly but surely, there are a lot of American citizens who have been trapped sort of in limbo for the past few weeks abroad who are now being able to get on flights back home through a lot of this work, literally 24/7 from a bunch of officials at the State Department, both in DC and at posts abroad.
And I also saw that MilAir, the Department of Defense, was helping with military aircraft to assist the State Department in bringing Americans home, or they're gearing up to do that. What do you know about that? I don't even know how that would work exactly.
Yeah, so there's a couple options there from the people I've spoken to, and one of them is just straight up military aircraft, which isn't necessarily ideal because obviously, you know, those planes were set up to send in troops and military equipment and might not have as much proper seating. There is this system that they're looking into called the Civil Reserve Air Fleet, or CRAF, because of course the U.S. government loves their acronyms. And CRAF is basically an agreement between the State Department, Defense Department, and commercial airline industry that during, you know, if there's ever wartime evacuation efforts or, you know, event of conflict, the U.S. government could call on commercial airliners to fly into a place and quickly evacuate as many Americans as possible. But this isn't really a silver bullet. It's not the flip of the switch. I think a lot of people just sort of, particularly here in Washington, just sort of think, oh, you know, the military can do it. Let's just send the military in as sort of a silver bullet fix. That's not quite the case here for a few reasons. One, these airlines need to get permission from host countries to land, which is a difficult diplomatic negotiation that the State Department has to take when foreign countries are like, we don't want any foreigners landing right now during this pandemic. We've seen that in the case of Honduras, of Peru, of Morocco, and a few other countries that have just shut down international airspace. Two, there's FAA regulations, federal late regulations on how much time that crews, American crews, need to spend on the ground after they've done a long flight before they can get back on the flight again that they have to work through. And three, they need to find not only planes, but also flight crews and medical staff that can be on hand in case they need to, you know, let's say fly a plane over from Washington Dulles Airport to Morocco, pick up a bunch of American citizens and fly back. And so these airlines might have the planes ready on standby, but they might not have the crew or the medical staff on hand to get on those planes in the first place. So there's a million different questions here, you know, hurdles that one might never think of if they're just thinking, why can't they just get a, you know, military plane, fly to Peru and pick people up and go back. A million different logistical hurdles that they have to get through before they can get these American citizens out. And obviously, the State Department officials are working overtime to try to fix this. The question is whether it's too little too late for a lot of these citizens.
So you, it reminds me, you're talking about the military and sort of being a silver bullet. You wrote an article for Foreign Policy called "The Military Alone Can't Rescue the U.S. from Coronavirus," which addressed that sort of broader idea. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that and why it's not a silver bullet, not just in this space, but more broadly in terms of the response to the coronavirus?
I think sort of early on last month, you saw Trump, other political leaders, even former Vice President Biden and Senator Sanders, who are still in the running for president on the Democratic side, say, oh, let's call up the National Guard and fix this and use the U.S. military. Obviously, the military is sort of the go-to first answer because they have the most resources and in theory are the most efficient on deploying, you know, assets like this in a quick fashion. The problem is when you're talking about what the military has and 300 million Americans, the military's assets can't really put a dent in what we would need as a country in terms of our medical infrastructure. So what they have been able to do is put together two large hospital ships, sending one to the West Coast and one, keeping one on the East Coast in New York. They also do have quickly deployable field hospitals that they can put together in cities that might be hard hit by the coronavirus. But these were not set up to deal with pandemics. These were set up to deal with, you know, trauma wounds, wartime rooms. So they don't have quite the equipment that you need to quarantine people, to keep the nurses and doctors completely safe and in protective gear. What they can do is take regular patients from hospitals out of the hospital and free up more beds for coronavirus patients. But that's sort of the knock-on effect they can do. And the Secretary of Defense, Esper, has been very clear repeatedly that they aren't going to be the catch-all fix and they don't have enough equipment to help. And I think the administration, you know, in recent weeks hasn't, or it has been pretty direct about that. They're not saying that the military can fix all this, but they are still calling them up to sort of be on standby and help out as best they can.
Yeah, that totally makes sense and consistent with the bunch of reporting that I've been seeing. So let's get back to the State Department. I want to talk a little bit about Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I have just been, maybe it's by virtue of social media and sort of the weirdness of social media, but just seems like some strange things coming from him. And I wanted to ask you about it. So, you know, he was criticized, you know, last week, as you mentioned before, for sort of lack of transparency with the workforce, with Congress. He's made these public statements criticizing, I think it was Iran, for downplaying the seriousness of this virus, just as President Trump, you know, was doing that for weeks. You know, most recently, it seems he was the source of this failure of the G7 to agree on a statement after the U.S. insisted on calling this coronavirus outbreak the Wuhan virus. So I feel like I'm getting sort of a bunch of random stories about what Mike Pompeo is doing. So give me a better sense for sort of what he has actually been doing, both in response to COVID-19, but more generally, and sort of what his, you know, operating philosophy is as you see it.
Yeah, well, to start, he has to walk and chew gum at the same time, because all the other problems in international diplomacy didn't magically go away when coronavirus hit. And so you've seen that this week. He actually, even with all of these travel restrictions and the global pandemic response, he flew to Afghanistan to meet with the Afghan president and his rival political foe to try to help them negotiate a new Afghan government amid this peace deal. Then he made a pit stop in Qatar to meet with Taliban negotiators. So he's still trying to keep all of these big foreign policy priorities afloat in the middle of this. He has not been quite as vocal or on the forefront of the coronavirus response as you've seen other top administration officials. You know, just in terms of these daily White House briefings that the President Trump and some of the top public health officials and Vice President Pence have been at, Pompeo's only been to one so far. And so it's clear that the State Department is at the epicenter of all this because they need to coordinate the global response. And they also, more importantly, need to help American citizens get home. But you just haven't seen him be quite as vocal or out in front on that issue as one might be. And a lot of critics I've talked to, both ones who served as political appointees in Democratic administrations, so obviously they aren't the biggest fans of this administration, but also some former career experts say that in a parallel universe, you'd see the United States and Secretary of State taking a lot more leadership in coordinating a global response. It wouldn't just be about, let's get Americans home, let's try to get as many, you know, medical supplies into the United States as possible. It would be, you know, we need to organize these big summits like the G7 or, you know, NATO meetings, or coordinate with the EU for a global response. And what you've been seeing instead is sort of letting other countries take the lead, getting into these tit for tat fights with Chinese officials about what to call the virus, focusing more on an American first approach to making sure we have all the supplies we need first, and emphasizing the international cooperation less, minus some lip service that you've seen and, you know, generic boilerplate statements and tweets that the State Department has put out.
And do you think in part the reason for that could be that, you know, the United States just really isn't in a great position domestically to face this problem? And so there's a lack of, as we know, a lack of sort of supplies, there's a lack of respirators. And I saw that there was sort of a quiet message that went out via the embassies to get our diplomats abroad to, you know, basically solicit foreign governments to, you know, sell us that type of equipment. So anyway, do you know sort of a little bit more about that? It seems very quiet, not a very public thing, but seems to me that need of our own, you know, protective equipment stuff could be hindering an ability to really be a leader in this space.
Yeah. I reported earlier this week that the State Department sent out this directive to its diplomats in countries in Eastern Europe, Eurasia, and the rest of Europe, to try to ramp up exports and production of life-saving medical equipment and protective gear to the United States. What was stark about this is this came from the an office that coordinated U.S. foreign assistance. So in normal times, this coordinates sending U.S. assistance out. And now these offices of foreign assistance are saying we're the ones in need of assistance from the countries that we deliver aid to. So it's a pretty stark example of just, you know, the dire straits that the United States could be in here. I think that the other concern to add on top of this is this big power overriding power struggle between the United States and China as what, you know, the global superpower, because China has really been trying to refurbish its image since it botched the initial response to the virus and it spread and turned into a pandemic. It's been sending doctors and medical supplies to some of the hardest hit countries, including Italy, including Iran, and really making a big show of it in its state-run media outlets. And sort of in a way on the PR front, it's almost running circles around the American side. You know, I talked to some foreign diplomats in Europe who said, you know, it used to be the Americans who would deliver these plane loads of doctors and medical equipment, and now it's the Chinese who are the first responders. That's not to say the U.S. isn't. The U.S. is still, you know, delivering aid and supplies out there, but just not in quite the high profile way that China is. And so it's in a way, you know, to the pessimist out there, it might be the beginning of a total sea change in how China is perceived among foreign countries. I don't think any foreign countries are going to forget that it was the Chinese government that botched the initial response to this pandemic. But I think a lot of them are saying, you know, when we called for help, the United States was asking for us for more medical supplies, but it was the Chinese that were sending their own. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really just begs this broader question of what the international order sort of looks like on the other side of this pandemic. And I agree with you. It does seem to me that China is certainly taking advantage of the moment to do what it can on sort of the soft power side. And yeah. I definitely think that will be a question going forward of, you know, are we seeing, is this an inflection point along the lines of, you know, World War II and the conclusion of World War II in terms of how the international order gets structured? And I'm sure folks are talking to you about that as well.
Yeah. And I think there's so many big picture questions that have been brewing in recent years about great power competition and Russia versus US and, like, you know, what does Trump mean for the 21st or 21st century US global leadership? And coronavirus has just completely accelerated all of those debates, and also offered like this real-time case study in what American first United States looks like in response to a truly global crisis.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So before we end, I want to ask you, you know, maybe a slightly more personal question. How has your ability to do reporting on the State Department and these issues changed since the beginning, since, you know, we're doing physical distancing, a lot of State Department employees are working from home. Is it different reporting on these issues now?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of my day-to-day job, I'm, you know, sitting in my pajamas on my couch or on my bed, frantically texting and calling experts and officials. And it's not quite as efficient as when I can actually go into the State Department or offices on Capitol Hill and talk to people face-to-face. So it's made it more challenging, but also, I mean, everyone's in this together. And even, you know, people that in government that, let's say, might not be the biggest fans of reporters, sort of, there's sort of this weird underlying camaraderie, like we're all in this together. So you can sort of bond a little bit with people you talk to for your job about, you know, sitting at home for day 11 of quarantine, or trying to balance, you know, walking your dog or trying to homeschool your kid or something like that while trying to get your work done. So at least from that side, there's a little bit of, in the sea of all this bad news, like there is a little bit of silver lining here that we're all sort of coming together and in this together. But in terms of the actual day-to-day job, yeah, it's definitely, I'm sure it's like everyone else in the country right now. It's more difficult to do your job when you're cooped up at home.
So Robbie, I see you just put out a new article about the State Department delaying the entrance of new Foreign Service officers. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the State Department was about to bring on board about 175 new diplomats to help replenish its ranks. And they told those diplomats to be that their start date is postponed indefinitely due to all the federal restrictions on having employees, you know, in the same room or go to these onboarding classes. So it just shows another knock-on effect for the U.S. government scrambling to respond to the pandemic. The unfortunate thing here is a lot of these people were supposed to start within the next 2 or 3 weeks, and they might have quit their jobs. And they right now are out of luck in terms of getting a salary, in terms of getting benefits like healthcare, in terms of getting allowances. They're just completely caught in limbo. So on that front, it's put them and these future diplomats in a really tough position, these Foreign Service officer generalists and specialists. But I think in terms of broader U.S. foreign policy, the State Department's been struggling for a few years, still feeling the sting of this pretty draconian hiring freeze under former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, senior diplomats leaving in droves due to morale issues or being pushed out. And so they need, particularly when they have this heavy lift of coordinating the global response to a pandemic, of bringing tens of thousands of Americans trapped abroad at home, they need all the help they can get. They're pretty thinly stretched. And right now, thanks to all these health concerns and the U.S. government's directives, they can't even bring on board a new Foreign Service officers to help out.
Yikes. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Robbie Gramer, thank you so much for coming on the Lawfare podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Michaela Fogel was our swashbuckling audio engineer, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.